Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat. Nayavangu Olive Movono. Au vakambula tikoyani anavali ni kakamburaki and FBC my Suva Fiji. No ia e Maori. Namaste and Yandra Vinaka. It is a pleasure to bring you ABC's Pacific Beat from Suva. On the show today, I'll take you to Papua New Guinea, where excitement is building ahead of the canonization of the country's first Catholic saint, Peter Torrot, and the Australian government has backflipped on a decision guaranteeing weekly hours for workers under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme, a move that has shocked unions.
It's really important that farm workers are protected in the same way in Australia as other workers here, and they already are subject to in many ways being bonded to the employer that they work for because they're not able under the visa to go off and get a job somewhere else or to earn extra income.
Those stories and more coming up on Pacific Beat. But first, excitement is building in Papua New Guinea ahead of the canonization of the country's first Catholic saint, Peter Torrot. Some of his descendants are traveling to the Vatican to witness Pope Leo XIV declare Blessed Peter Torrot a saint during a ceremony in St. Peter's Basilica on Sunday evening local time. Thousands of others are expected to watch a telecast of the ceremony in his home village in East New Britain as Belinda Cora reports.
Blessed Peter Torrot was just 33 years old when he was killed through lethal injection by Japanese soldiers in 1945. He was arrested and martyred for opposing polygamy following an order executed by the Japanese authorities that wanted to reintroduce the practice. This all happened in his village of Rakunai, where he is originally from. Despite Japanese restrictions on Christian practices, Peter secretly organized catechism classes, prepared couples for marriage, taught children, visited the sick, and distributed Holy Communion across villages, often walking for 5 to 6 hours to reach them. According to the Catholic Church, such pastoral work and the death of Blessed Peter Torrot deserves the recognition of sainthood. Father Thomas Ravaioli is an Argentine missionary and is the vice postulator of the canonization of Peter Torrot and has worked in PNG for 15 years.
You should follow the example of this man because this man was a real follower, a real disciple of Jesus. So that is the meaning of canonization. The church is telling us, see Peter Torrot, look at him and try to follow his example. And in that way, you will be a real follower of Christ, a real disciple.
Father Ravaioli explains why it has taken this long to recognize the life and work of Peter Torrot.
It is a work that has to be done here in Papua New Guinea, but also in Rome. So we didn't know very much about the situation in Rome. So it was in 2020 when the bishops asked me to go to Rome and to try to find out. And after I went there, I had a meeting in the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints. I was updated about the situation. And from that moment, 5 years ago, 2020, I was appointed to be in charge of this phase of the cause here in Papua New Guinea.
Peter Torrot Senat is one of three of Peter Torrot's grandchildren who will also be travelling to the Vatican City to be part of a special service for his grandfather's canonization on Sunday.
It's quite a privilege for us to be attending a ceremony that, you know, we would never thought in our lifetime that we'd be attending such a church event. And we thank God that, you know, we're still alive and, you know, we'll be attending this special location with other pilgrims and other bishops also from Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands at this event.
He recalls the work of his grandfather through stories told to him by his mother, Rufina, who is the only child to Blessed Peter Torot.
The stories were basically around his faith and what he died for, as he stood firm on the Christian values of honoring one marriage partner. And that was something that, the Japanese were trying to introduce polygamy and all this. And Blessed Peter Torot basically stood against that. And that was because of his faith that he was killed at Gunayara in Rabaul.
Meanwhile, preparations are well underway at the Rakunai Catholic Church for the live telecast and celebratory evening of Blessed Peter Torot's canonization on Sunday evening. Hundreds are expected from all around the country and the region to celebrate the work and life of Blessed Peter Torot. Henry Tevolo is the chairman of the Rakunai Catholic Parish in East New Britain province.
There are so many pilgrims stay with us already here at Rakunai Pilgrim Center. They're from Caribbean, they're from the islands. So many people will come. The parishes, near parishes, will come and join us with this program. So maybe 3,000 to 5,000.
That was Henry Tevelo from the Rakunai Parish, ending that report from my Susa and colleague, Belinda Cora.
Pacific Beat.
The Australian government has backflipped on a decision guaranteeing weekly hours for workers under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility, or PALM scheme, a move that has shocked unions. In 2023, the government announced the scheme's short-term workers would be guaranteed 30 hours of work each week. This was due to be introduced in April next year, but this week, the PALM scheme's website was updated to confirm that this had been dropped, and instead, the existing requirement for 120 hours of work averaged over 4 weeks to be made permanent. The Australian Council of Trade Unions President Michael O'Neill told Lucy Cooper it was a terrible move from the government.
It's really important that PALM workers are protected in the same way in Australia as other workers here. And they already are subject to, in many ways, being bonded to the employer that they work for because they're not able under the visa to go off and get a job somewhere else or to earn extra income. So they're vulnerable to exploitation. And it's really important that they receive a weekly wage, which is what the government committed to do. To stop the averaging of these workers' pay. And initially they announced that in 2023. They delayed it twice, but committed to doing it as of the 1st of April next year. And now they've dumped that commitment.
Why is it important for the government to implement 30 minimum hours per week rather than 120 hours across the 4 weeks?
Well, the problem with averaging pay over a four-week period is that workers could have very low hours and pay over, say, the first 3 weeks and then have additional hours in the last week of a month. That leaves people short. It means that they don't have enough money to cover basic costs to support themselves, may have to rely on charity or others for food and essentials. And also, one of the characteristics of the PALM program is that employers can deduct payments for things like accommodation and travel. So this leaves workers often shortchanged, not able to have enough income for what they need, which was why we were campaigning and very pleased the government committed to guaranteeing the 30 hours minimum per week. And we're shocked that the government has backflipped on this commitment.
Employment of Workplace Relations Minister Amanda Rishworth said that keeping the current arrangements will continue to ensure income security for PALM workers while allow PALM scheme employers flexibility to deal with unexpected disruptions such as natural disasters. What does the ACTU make of these comments?
Well, there's already arrangements under the scheme to deal with things like natural disasters. So that is already in place. It's not necessary to have this change to be able to give that flexibility to employers. That was already there. What this does is just make workers more likely to be exploited. And there's already exploitation under this program. And we need to clean it up. We need to make sure that the opportunity for workers from the Pacific to come to Australia marry and work here isn't on the basis of them not receiving fair pay and conditions and safe work arrangements. So it should be the minimum we can do in Australia to say that by welcoming Pacific workers here, they should have the same rights and protections as other workers. And if other workers don't receive enough pay or hours when they're working in Australia, they're entitled to go off and work for somebody else and pick up extra pay and hours working for another employer. Palm workers don't have that right. So they're really vulnerable. If they go and work for someone else, they're breaching their visa, and that leaves them even more open to exploitation.
The backflip on the decision has been welcomed by farmers and employer groups, as they said the guaranteed 30 hours of work each week was unworkable as it failed to reflect the nature of seasonal work. Does the ACTU accept that 30 hours wasn't cohesive to the type of work that is required on a farm?
No, we don't accept that. And the employers and the Farmers Federation made exactly the same claims when there was a change from averaging over 9 months to 1 month for workers' pay. They said this would be a terrible thing. They wouldn't be able to cope with it. And of course, they have coped with it. It's always the same complaint. The other thing to know is large numbers of palm workers work in sheds. There's, you know, huge numbers of agriculture workers under this program that are not working outside in the elements, and the program already accounts for special circumstances if there is issues to do with extreme weather. So I don't accept those arguments from the employers at all.
And finally, news of this decision for the wider public came in the form of a document uploaded to the Palm Scheme website. There was no formal announcement. What do you make of this?
Well, I think this is the government hiding this announcement and not wanting to announce publicly that they'd backflipped on a commitment to give workers in Australia better rights. And I understand that they didn't want to put that up in lights, but it isn't acceptable. It is a change that needs to be reversed. It's not a fair process for the workers that are going to be impacted from the Pacific. We think this is an important program. We support unions, support the Palm program, but not at the expense of those workers that come here not being protected and having worker rights that equate to workers in Australia.
The Australian Council of Trade Unions President Michelle O'Neill. The ABC has requested a response from the federal government.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Papua New Guinea has just rolled out a new green fee, a charge on people travelling into PNG on foreign passports. It costs 50 kina and is aimed at offsetting carbon footprints and funding climate programs. Our reporter Jordan Fennell spoke to Deborah Sungi, the acting managing director of Papua New Guinea's Climate Change and Development Authority, to find out more.
The green fee is actually a non-tax, and it is a way of a carbon offset mechanism that we are introducing under the Climate Change Management Act and by law. And it is actually the mechanism that is designed to really capture voluntary contributions from external visitors, contributing very specifically to the tourism sector. And its whole purpose is to ensure that the sustainable tourism, including the management of marine biodiversity.
And so you said that it's a voluntary fee, is it?
Yeah, it's more like a voluntary contribution from external visitors.
So external visitors don't have to pay it. They can pay it if they want to. Is that what you mean?
Well, by law, it doesn't say that they should not be paying it. We are encouraging external visitors to really contribute in terms of the offset in using the services in the country whilst being here.
Is there any repercussion for a traveller who decides not to pay the green fee?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, there's no penalty as it is by law. That's the reason why we are classifying this as a non-tax revenue and a voluntary contribution in terms of the carbon offset. But it is something that we would encourage, and we're working very closely with our key stakeholders at the airport, at the front lines, to ensure that this is being collected and addressed, and visitors should comply with, given that this is a law that we have set in place, and we would really encourage everyone to adhere to the law that we have set in the country.
And so how will this be enforced? How will someone who's visiting PNG know that they are meant to pay this fee?
So we have actually been advocating for the green fees since 2020 and up to the amendment of the Climate Change Management Act. And after the enactment of the Climate Change Management Act back in 2023, we have ran out notices concurrently and have been mentioning this to media and having one-on-one consultations with all sectors to really inform the public that this is the fee that we'll be collecting.
How did you communicate with partners externally so that visitors, because what I'm thinking of is, I guess, that if I'm here in Australia and I am planning to travel to PNG and I go to the airport, does the Australian airport tell me that I'm meant to pay a fee when I arrive? How do I know I'm meant to pay a fee before I get into Port Moresby?
It is very common for any traveller who travels into any countries. Obviously, you have to check the requirements that you need to have before you travel into the country. So that's basically very important in terms of your visa, in terms of any fees that you need to pay. All these are online, and that is a requirement that we all check before to ensure that we travel. We tick off the checklist. So, I mean, I'm pretty sure this is for any traveler. Traveling would know about this information that is out and online and is there for the public to view. But also at the same time, we are working very closely now with the airline companies to ensure that these messages are being captured because it is not at the arrival. These fees are collected at the departure. So it's easy when you arrive, those information are there at the arrivals. And then before departure, you pay the 50 kina before getting on the flight.
Oh, okay. So you pay when you are leaving PNG?
Yes. Yes.
What kind of revenue do you expect to generate in this first year?
So estimated cost that we have estimated, and that's only for the tourism sector. We've not really deep dive into doing a full analysis on the corporate business visitors that comes in. We are looking at around, and that's half of the year that was estimated. We're looking at around 7 to 11 million, around that range that we are looking at to collect that revenue.
Now, you touched on it a little bit earlier about where this money is going. Could you just expand it a little bit? You said it's going to be for carbon offsetting, mm-hmm. For the tourism sector. Where exactly is this money going to flow into?
So the collection of the fees is collected into a consolidated revenue fund, which is managed by the Department of Finance. So one trust account is for the adaptation component, and the other trust is for the mitigation component. And the activities will be specifically for the tourism, sustainable tourism sector, and the marine conservation and biodiversity areas.
What feedback have you had from travelers? How did that process go on day one?
It's really flowing very well, and I can see that the travelers are really, really keen and also very supportive of the idea of, you know, paying a green fee, and that's for the offset, and it's for the protection of the environment, etc. So it's really something that is not negative, seen as negative to the travelers. They are very supportive. There's a little bit of challenge only with the information that still needs to be reaching a number of visitors, and that's especially around a number of visitors who we have not really translated the information to the different languages. So that's the only challenge that we face, which we've addressed on the first day. But other than that, the general public is and travelers are really welcoming to the initiative.
That was Deborah Sigi, the Acting Managing Director of Papua New Guinea's Climate Change and Development Authority. Yanda vinaka malelele and tala falava. If you're just joining us, this is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Welcome. My name is Livia Muvono, coming to you from Suva in Fiji. Still to come on the show, the Solomon Islands men's basketball side is hoping for a never-before-achieved Melanesian Cup title after securing a historic win against Fiji at home in Honiara. And our Solomon Islands reporter, Kristen Rita Aumanu-Leong, has a story coming up about the 22-year-old local basketballer that's been the talk of the town.
I have drawn so much inspiration from my family who all play basketball. I step into it and I love it. They inspire me to do better.
Keep going on.
That's coming up soon, but first, time to get the latest news headlines from around the region.
Hold the front page!
So let's find out what is making news around the Pacific region. And to do that, I am joined by our producer, Jordan Fennell. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Lithe. Happy Friday.
Oh, it is Friday, isn't it? It just occurred to me. It's so good to have you back here. Let's kick off in France, where the French Senate has endorsed the postponement of New Caledonia's provincial elections.
Yeah, that's right. So this legislation has just passed its first hurdle in the French Senate. The postponement of these provincial polls in New Caledonia was actually approved by New Caledonia's Congress earlier this month, and now it is moving through the French Senate. This is actually all part of an implementation process of the Bougival Accord, which was signed back in July. That was, of course, signed by pro-independence parties and loyalist parties in New Caledonia. Excuse me. That would see New Caledonia become a French state and achieve more autonomy. Now, the provincial elections have been postponed this year in order to give all those parties involved more time to negotiate the draft text of that Bougival Accord. They're looking to postpone the provincial elections until June 2026 next year. And that is, of course, going to be after the anticipated referendum on the Bougival Accord, which is set to happen in February 2026 to see if New Caledonians will adopt the Bougival Accord. But of course, Lithe, as we know, some pro-independence parties have decided they've retracted their support of the current draft text. There's still a lot of negotiations to go on, so we will have to wait and see how that all unfolds.
It sounds like we've got some exciting few months ahead of us, Jordan.
Yes, definitely. Lots, as always, going on in New Caledonia.
That's right. Well, now, Pacific climate resilience experts are warning that rats and weeds are threatening climate resilience in the region. But what more do we know?
Yeah, so this is a report coming from Rinzi, and they've looked at this study that's come out from SPREP, the Pacific Regional Environment Program. And SPREP have been studying invasive species management when it comes to climate resilience. They've found that climate change means that anything that's sort of pre-existing as climate change ramps up exacerbates all the impacts of things like invasive species. The manager of the program, Dominique Sadler, says that climate change, they've found, creates disturbances of these invasive species like rats, weeds, pigs as well, and it causes this sort of negative feedback loop. SPREP has found that getting rid of things like the invasive rats and pigs can show that seabirds can then thrive. And then when seabirds are thriving, that can in turn improve the health of the reefs in the Pacific. Some evidence have also seen through their studies is there are examples of islands where a year after an invasive rat species has been removed, they've seen turtles return to nesting on those islands, and then they've seen life come back to the islands. So, yeah, some fascinating research coming out of SPREP around that connection between, I guess, and antagonistic aspects in the Pacific, invasive species plus climate change, and what can happen when you try and mitigate that.
That's a really exciting story, Jordan, and one I think I'm going to be looking at a little bit deeper after this. Thank you for that.
Of course, no worries.
And the winner is... Nah, it's too cliche. Ladies and gentlemen... Nah, it's too formal.
Hey, Michael Chow, what you doing?
Jake McGuire, we're announcing the Pacific Break winner on this Thursday, and I need to nail it.
Ah, yes, after meeting our very talented finalists over the last few weeks on Nisha Daily, we finally get to reveal the 2025 Pacific Break winner.
Mm-hmm, so tune into Nisha Daily from 7 a.m. PNG time this coming Thursday as we call the winner to let them know.
Tune in, you won't want to miss it.
The Solomon Islands basketball side is hoping for a never-before-achieved Melanesian Cup title after securing a historic win against Fiji at home in Honiara. The finals are expected over the weekend, where two of the top teams will have direct passes to the 2027 Pacific Games. But as Chris and Rita Aumanu Leong reports in Honiara, it's a 22-year-old local basketballer that's been the talk of the town.
On the court, Bart Kebibasia is a standout player. Outside the box, he is mommy's boy.
So me so proud. Me
I'm so proud of my baby boy, Kirby.
Margaret Basia is Kirby's mom, a former national rep who dedicated her life to the game's development in the country.
Him, a big bro, him.
He would tag along with his oldest brother, Agustin, who became his coach. What started from a homemade court to the international space makes me proud. Watching Kirby grow under his brother's wings, my baby, to me, he is number one in Solomon Islands.
I'm number one in Solomon Island.
Kirby isn't the only Basia in this tournament. His sisters are also representing their country. The 22-year-old point guard is the youngest in a family of seven. All of them started dribbling basketballs from a very young age.
I have drawn so much inspiration from my family, who all play basketball. I step into it and I love it. They inspire me to do better.
Kirby is praised for his quickness, court vision and tireless motto. On Monday, a packed Friendship Hall erupted as the final buzzer sounded, marking a landmark moment for Solomon Islands basketball, their first ever win against Fiji.
Been playing for so long now.
We have been playing together for so long. Our chemistry and connection is there. We just need to find the momentum and keep on playing.
Papua New Guinea remain unbeaten and are in the top contention to make it to the finals. Fiji earned a commanding 123-61 victory over Vanuatu in a must-win match. Host Solomon Islands have beaten Fiji, lost to defending champions New Caledonia and Papua New Guinea as well yesterday. Kebibasia feels the weight of expectation, with Solomon Islands hosting the third FIBA Melanesian Cup.
Big one now. Shootings, bro.
My shootings could be better synchronized, so I'll work harder in the next game.
Go back, train hard for next game, bro.
As a former national rep, Kirby's brother, Austin Basia, still finds his way cheering from the sidelines. He says Kirby is special.
Kirby is the better basketballer. He learnt a lot from our siblings. We have passed on only the good techniques. He brings himself together and now we can see his performance.
Give me looking performance blame this time. Yeah.
Austin was one of the three senior players in 2022 who helped to rebuild the sport in the country. He is confident that basketball's popularity will grow. For him, it's investing in the younger generation.
We know the current team is a special group that we have put together. That historical win against Fiji, it's a big moment for basketball in Solomon Islands.
Big moment for basketball in Solomon Islands too.
And in keeping the family's passion alive, Austin hopes his son, Uzziah, picks up the game just like he once did.
That one, I think every father will like him for.
It's any father's dream that his child can continue on with the legacy. I hope the same for mine.
But the game's the same.
And that was former basketball rep Austin Basia ending that story by the ABC's reporter in the Solomon Islands, Chris and Rita Aumanu Leong. A long way from the Pacific, there have been big celebrations in Cape Verde over the last few days after they became the second smallest country ever to qualify for the FIFA Men's World Cup. But there is a country even smaller than the African island nation that will be playing the World Cup football in just a few days' time, and that's Samoa. They'll make their debut at the Under-17 Women's World Cup in Morocco at 5 a.m. Apia time on Monday morning when they take on France. And with Samoa already qualified for the 2026 World Cup as well, coach Juan Cheng Urrea says some of his players will still be young enough to play in that tournament too.
We have girls there that can play even in three World Cups, if that's the case. It doesn't really matter if you're an 08 or an 010 or 011. You know, if you gel within the team, if you know, competent, cognitive, and then if you mix well with the team, then that's all we need. You know, that's how we pick the team. It's not an easy task based now that we have two full squads. But yeah, we narrow it down. We don't really see it as a problem. For us, it was more as a blessing that we had that opportunity to pick from two different squads that have qualified for the World Cup. But like I said, not an easy task. You know, it's never a perfect world, but we do have our filters. And luckily, we did have quite a few camps this year. We went to the US twice. We had a camp in Samoa. We had a tournament in Samoa. And now we're here. So we just utilize objective data to finalize the squad.
Have you, though, been put in a position where you've had to leave some players out who would only be able to take part in this World Cup because they'll be overage next time?
We definitely did. We definitely did. But yeah, I mean, that's just a decision that we took. But we don't really see it as an age. You know, if you're 2008, then you take priority over a 2010. For us, it's more about who's connected with the team, who's dealing with the team, who's doing this, who's being a constant within our team. And oh, there's a lot of variables within our staff. We call it a 7-step filter that we go through in order to make a final decision. But yeah, there were some 2008s. Yes, absolutely. But also, there were some 2010s that we also left out. So never an easy task.
And the players that are going to be at the World Cup, are there any from Samoa itself or are they all from the diaspora?
That's a good question. I always say if you're eligible to represent Samoa, then you are Samoan. You are just Samoan playing overseas. Based in Samoa, yes, one of our goalkeepers moved to Auckland a couple of weeks ago just because of family, but she grew up in Samoa. She's been our starting goalie over the past two World Cup qualifiers, and we understand the goalkeeper is a key part of our Under-17 women's team. So yeah, she's a constant for us. She plays for Lepea in Samoa. And then the other girls, they do play overseas. The majority in the US, but hopefully this is a good way for the girls to ignite or to keep igniting that fire of soccer in Samoa. We have seen a lot of growth over the last year.
The fact that you have a number of players in your squad who would be eligible to go to next year's World Cup as well, will that play a significant role in their mindset, if you like? In other words, they have an opportunity at this tournament to demonstrate that they can play on the world stage, to impress you and say, we want to be here next year as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And we saw that also with the recent Under-16 qualifiers. We returned 12 players from the previous World Cup qualifiers. So for us, you know, like build like a blueprint for the girls has been really helpful, not only for us as a team, but also most important for them as players just to grow. And I think, like you said, this World Cup will be an amazing chance for them to demonstrate what they can do, not for to show us, but also to show them and to showcase their last name, their village in Samoa, and also to make Samoa proud.
Let's look at what lies ahead for your players. Matches against France, against Nigeria, against Canada. A couple of years ago, nobody would ever thought that Samoa would be in a position to play teams like that.
I told FIFA the other day that it is a fairy tale for us, but to be honest, we've been working for it. You know, we've been working for it in order to qualify, not once, but twice. So we are as ready as we can be. We always say that we have to have peace within ourselves, that we're doing everything we can with what we have in order to be ready. So that is the definition of being at peace. And we always tell that to the girls. You know, it could look like a David versus Goliath, you know, but we're not going to hide. We're not going to run away. We're going to stand tall. We might be the smallest nation ever to play in a FIFA World Cup, male or woman. But we do have the biggest heart, and hopefully we can show that. Everyone loves an underdog story, so why not us?
Chee-hoo, we love an underdog story. That was head coach Won Cheng Urea on the line from the Samoan camp at the 2025 Under-17 Women's World Cup in Morocco. And he was talking to Richard Ewart.
Kick off your Sunday with Kuntamari Crofts on Pacific Sundays, right here on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Sundays is a laid-back weekly wrap of all things Pacific, from news, sport, and entertainment to the best island music vibes. So whether you're chilling out, heading off to church, or catching up with family, be entertained as you do it with Pacific Sundays. Every Sunday at 6 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Rugby League's Pacific superstars will trade their jerseys for national colours when the 2025 Pacific Championships kicks off tomorrow. The Fiji Mbati will kick off the Pacific Bowl tomorrow against the Cook Islanders, followed by a Pacific Cup clash between Toa Samoa and Aotearoa New Zealand. It's a much-anticipated return for Toa Samoa, who missed the tournament last year. And to find out more about how the competition is shaping up, we are joined by author and Rugby League writer Patrick Skeen. Patrick, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Litha, and what a great time it is, Pacific Championship time.
That's so exciting. You must be positively excited about the next few days.
I think we're just seeing in the NRL's greatest season ever, to follow on from that with the biggest Pacific Championships ever. It's just an extension of rugby league's growth and momentum. And rather than it being a little add-on at the end of the season, it really has blossomed into its own major thing.
And it sounds like it'll be a truly Pacific tournament this year, right? With Australia not participating, will not having the Kangaroos hurt the tournament or enhance it, do you think?
I think not having Samoa last year hurt the tournament when they went to play England. So I think Australia and England having an Ashes series is very healthy for the game. It's been a long time since that has happened. But I think not having Samoa there, we missed out on the big Samoa-Tonga clash, which I believe one day will have the same fervour as Origin. It's shaping like that. It's a real global game that is loved and watched everywhere.
Samoa are returning to the tournament to replace Australia. But how can the winners of the Men's Pacific Cup ever be the true champions when there's always one team missing?
I think we're going to get to, the true champions, we don't even know if they're the true champions, because the Melanesian Bowl with Fiji, Bati and the Kumuls, they are getting to the stage where they could be strong enough to challenge one of the winners of the Pacific Cup. So even within the actual Pacific Championships as it is now, I think we don't have a true winner. So this has been a slowly evolving competition. But I think whether Australia is there or not, I think this year we're going to show that if Australia wants to play England, or Australia is in here, the tournament doesn't depend on Australia being in there anymore, and I think that's healthy.
Yeah. Which sides have changed or improved the most since last year?
I think all eyes are on Samoa now. Payne Haas, arguably the greatest rugby league forward we've ever seen, that's what some people are saying, has come back to play for Samoa, and that will be an incredible, incredible match against the Kiwis. The Kiwis, you would say, are favoured, but seeing the big, Papali'i versus Papali'i is going to be fascinating. Mm-hmm. But the big boppers there going against each other in Mount Smart Stadium is going to be absolutely fantastic on Sunday.
I'm quite envious of the people that get to watch that game. But tell me, Samoa's captain, Stephen Crichton, has been ruled out. However, there's been a rise in other Pacific leaders. Can you expand on that?
I think what we're seeing now is the first generation of Pacific NRL captains coming through. And if you look at Apisai Corasau and you look at Stephen Crichton, they're now the leaders of NRL clubs. So that's been a real blow to both Fiji and to Samoa to lose NRL level leaders, and that's another change. These teams used to be the players that Australia and New Zealand rejected. Now we have NRL captains who are providing leadership for these Pacific teams. So I think Stephen Crichton's loss to Samoa will be a real blow, and we'll see how that plays out.
I see. It's an interesting format, though, the Pacific Champs, as it features two separate tournaments, you know, both the Pacific Cup and the Pacific Bowl. My home country, Fiji, for example, plays in the Pacific Bowl, despite having lots of NRL talent. Should there be a promotion relegation system implemented, do you think?
I think at this stage, if we just had the champion of one versus the champion of another, because Fiji, even though Fiji have been the story in the rise of international rugby league recently, really threatening people in the last World Cup, I think Fiji versus the Kumuls, the Bati versus the Kumuls are winning that 5-1 in head-to-head series since the Pacific competition started in 2014 in some shape or form. So I think we've got a really good rivalry happening there, and I think Fiji should concentrate on beating the Kumuls right now, because that's a great challenge in front of it. And if they do that, I think the winner of that game should definitely win, play the winner. In future versions, should play the winner. And I think that would make this a true Pacific Championship, the Melanesian champions versus the Polynesian champions. I think that would bring it to life even further.
And how is the women's tournament shaping up? I have to admit, this is my favorite part of all of the rugby that happens in the Pacific. With Fiji absent on the World Cup qualification duty, how is the women's tournament looking?
Well, I think it's looking very good. PNG Orchids versus the Cook Islands Moana, which happens this Saturday, I think will be one of the most fascinating games of the tournament. Cook Islands Moana are strong, and you would say they are favoured, but since 2017, we've seen the constant rise of the Orchids. So I would look out for that to be one of the games of the tournament. I expect the Kiwi Ferns to beat a fast-rising Fetu Samoa on the Sunday. And that brings up a larger question as well, is why have they scheduled for Samoan and Tongan games to be on Sundays when we know church will have an impact? It's one of the strangest scheduling. I think you could swap around the Pacific Bowl to play on Sunday. It wouldn't have that much of an impact in PNG, but I don't quite understand why they have the Polynesian games on Sundays, because I think they would go close to selling some of those matches out in New Zealand, and now it may struggle. We also have the fascinating thing of Tonga. They've moved the game versus New Zealand from Mount Smart Stadium to Eden Park, and that's an extra 20,000 people. So Tonga being in the tournament last year, Tonga, its incredible run in the 2017 World Cup, they're actually moving them to the 50,000 stadium in New Zealand, which is where the All Blacks play. And that's nothing to do with Australia. That's all pure Pacific Rugby League and Pacific Rugby League passion. So that's another indicator of the incredible growth of this tournament.
And just finally, how will the finalists for the November 9th game be determined?
Oh, it's a strange, you know, you've only got three teams in each, and that's why if Australia would return and they would have four teams in there, it could be a classic pool. But right now it will be the one with the most wins, and then it comes down to points difference, which always concerns me a little bit. But again, we've got a tournament that is a work in progress. It will be the biggest version of it this year. And I think if they can get that out to, if they can get the main one out to four teams when Australia is there, it'll be a lot easier. I'm never comfortable with someone beating someone yet still somehow qualifying or not qualifying, and the other team goes ahead. So still a work in progress, but we have now reached the stage where this is not a little government add-on at the end of the year. This is a commercial powerhouse. It's an extension of the NRL's reach now. And for me, I read an article on it. I'm seeing so many positive articles on it this year. But the quote was from one journalist: the Pacific Championship started as a diplomatic experiment, but it's transformed into a tournament that's competitive, commercially potent, culturally driven, and that's fueling rugby league's growth. And I think a lot of Pacific people, when they read that, can actually really hope, you know, their chest should burst with pride at how far they have come in rugby league and what they are now contributing to rugby league as a net gain, rather than, you know, just being a side piece to the game. It really is. And I believe the Pacific are the only, for 100 years, rugby league didn't grow internationally. And now we have five, maybe six teams eventually that can win the World Cup, which is what rugby union has as well. So the Pacific teams are actually all around the world driving the global growth of rugby league. So bravo for the resilience, and I believe it's something we should absolutely celebrate now.
And my chest is positively bursting with pride right now as you say that. That was author and rugby league writer Patrick Skeen. And the Pacific Champs will kick off from midday tomorrow, PNG time, with the PNG Orchids against the Cook Islands Moana. Kiwi Ferns, Fetu Samoa, Fiji Mbati, Cook Islands Men, the Kiwi Men, and Toa Samoa will all follow throughout the day. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at our main stories today. Excitement is building in Papua New Guinea ahead of the canonization of the country's first Catholic saint, Peter Toro, this weekend. Vinaka vaka levuna vaka roronga tika mai. I'll be back at the same time next week, but that's 6 a.m. PNG time on the morning show next week. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because next is Nija Daily. Vinaka vaka levu, nite more than manda.